Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is Rachel Bloom, the comedian, actress, writer, singer, and star of the television show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Bloom has a new book out, I Want to Be Where the Normal People Are. She's joined in conversation by actress Yael Groglas. And now join Heather Moran, CEO of Six and I, as she introduces Rachel Bloom and Yael Groglas.
Hi, everyone. I'm Heather Moran, and I'm the CEO of Six and I. And on behalf of our entire team, thank you so much for being here with us tonight. It's always amazing to welcome past guests back to Six and I and celebrate how much they've done since they were last with us. Back in 2014, Rachel Bloom headlined a Hanukkah-themed comedy show at Six and I. And for everyone in the room that night, there was no doubt that Rachel was a one-of-a-kind star. The following year, Rebecca Bunch came into our lives and Crazy Ex-Girlfriend redefined what a TV musical dramedy could be. Rachel co-created, co-executive produced, and of course, starred in the show. She won both a Golden Globe and a Critics' Choice Award for her unforgettable performance. The authenticity, the creativity, the cleverness that define Rachel in her acting, comedy, and singing are also found throughout the pages of her debut book, I Want to Be Where the Normal People Are. From the spiraling thoughts in her head to navigating bullies in middle school, Rachel shares an unvarnished look at a life often lived on the outside looking in. Through her vulnerability, her candor, and her perspective, Rachel's story becomes a redemptive manifesto for all of us who felt like we've been really weird at some point in our lives. And tonight, we could not be more excited for Rachel Bloom to be in conversation with Yael Groglas. Her iconic portrayal of Petra Solano and Edzenka in Jane the Virgin showcased Yael's tremendous capacity for range and complexity as an actress. Born in Paris and raised in Israel, Yael began her acting career as the lead in two hit Israeli TV series, which translate to The Island and Give It a Rest. Her film credits include An Interview with God, as well as the horror film Jerusalem. And please welcome Rachel Bloom and Yael Groglas into your homes.
Hi.
There we go.
Step one complete. I managed to activate the video. Hi, Rachel.
You did it. I'm the one who f***ed it up.
Last time we saw each other in person, we were both extremely pregnant and chowing on Ethiopian food.
Oh, yes, we were. We were indeed. What a time. I guess that was, God, if there's anything that isn't like a COVID-safe meal, it's like us all sharing plates and eating with our hands. It's lovely to see you.
And we're here to talk about I Want to Be Where the Normal People Are.
Beautiful.
Is a genius title.
Thank you.
Genius. I didn't get it at first. And someone pointed out to me, you know, the Little Mermaid reference. And I was like, what? Am I stupid? Why didn't I get it? And I realized it's because I was raised on a Little Mermaid in Hebrew.
What is that called?
So unless you would have called it that. Yeah. And once I got it, I was like, oh, it's amazing. It's perfect.
How do you say mermaid in Hebrew?
Batayam.
Batayam.
It's like,
what does that break down to? Does that mean like lady tail sea time?
It's like bat haktana is like bat is daughter, yam is sea, and ktana is little. So it's like daughter sea little.
Dr. Sea Little. I love that movie where she talks to the animals.
So your book came out what, yesterday? How does it feel?
I mean, it's a relief because I can remember the amount of time I had that I had a book deal and I hadn't done any work.
Really?
And there is nothing scarier than saying, oh yeah, I have a book deal And people like, oh, how far along are you? And being like, oh, haven't started.
I can imagine.
It is such a looming. And I would say, like, my husband and I were trying to figure out expenses for like a house renovation or something. And I was like, well, and I have that money coming in from the book. And he was like, have you started writing that? I was like, no, not at all. So he has said that in the back of his mind, he's like, she's going to have to give that money back. She's not going to finish this book.
And then you kind of have to supply a book.
It's the best writing deadline. That's like my biggest tip is hold yourself accountable to people to the point where you will be in legal trouble if you don't write something.
Maybe it'll work for me because I can't get anything done.
Give yourself a deadline. That's my tip.
Someone sue you or take money away.
Or someone will full on sue you. Actually, I remember that was like the first or second season of Girls. She hadn't worked on a book and she tried to write a whole book in a day. And then she called her parents to ask if she could have money to pay back the people who published her book. And they were like, you're on your own. You're irresponsible. And I really connected with that.
Now it's out and it's doing well. And it's basically, to me, it felt like, well, first of all, I loved the book. I love the book.
Thank you.
I love you. You're a good friend of mine, but I didn't know what I was agreeing to when I hadn't read the book when I agreed to do this. And then I got the book and I'm like, more than I thought that I would. And I absolutely adore it. I think it's genius. It's playful. It's so fun. It deals with hard things in a fun way, which is exactly the kind of way that I like to read about, you know, tough moments and things. And many times it felt to me like I was reading parts of my own diary of things that I forgot happened to me or some things that did happen to me, you know? And I was like, it was really moving. And you know, in it, you start out actually with a brilliant piece that seems like something you would have written now. You know, it's a very smart thing about what is it to be normal and is anybody normal? And I love that. And I was like, oh, that's so wise. And you ended, you know, with like 12-year-old me. I'm like, are you kidding me? You wrote that when you were 12.
Oh, I'm glad you were impressed. I mean, the part of the poem that I thought maybe gave it away, but maybe I'm selling myself short was like,
I'm opening
my book right now. I say like, what is normal? Who is normal? Your neighbors? Your Freddie Prinze Jr. lookalike crush?
I feel like you would still say that.
I guess I would. And Freddie Prinze Jr. is still really hot.
I mean, I remember that. Those posters, you know, I don't have them anymore, but they were important.
I had some ripped out magazine pictures of him up in my room. But like next to the pictures I had of like Colin Firth from Pride and Prejudice and like Alan Rickman in Dogma. I think I like partially put the Freddie Prinze Jr. and Paul Walker pictures up to be like, this is what a normal teenager does. But then secretly like masturbating to the idea of like Henry Higgins telling me that I'm not speaking English correctly.
Like that's a lot.
That was actually something. Oh my God. I'm just remembering now an essay I never wrote for the book because I did the Harry Potter fan fiction in the book was, it was going to be like, I think it was going to be like, oh, it's because I put in the erotic poetry. It was going to be like erotic fiction that I would write, like erotic fan fiction. And it was me and Mr. Darcy at Disneyland.
Oh my God.
It was like, I think I started it and I was like, this has too much overlap with things I'm already doing. But somewhere out there on my computer, there are a couple paragraphs of like, Mr. Darcy purchased the churro barely while looking down on it. I don't know.
I'm sure there's, you know, there's porn out there for every genre and for every, you know, like fetish. And that's, you know, I'm sure there's an audience for it.
I think there's a big audience for it, Yael.
You have a whole brilliant paragraph in there, a whole brilliant piece in there about you winning the Golden Globe and your dog not giving a
Yeah, she doesn't care. That's what's beautiful, I think, about having a dog and now a baby is like, they don't care. they don't, my dog doesn't have, I don't think my dog knows what my name is.
Oh, no, she has a name for you.
Oh, yes, of course. I think I have her call me Stepdad Lady because I'm her stepdad, but I'm a lady. The book came and I gave it to my daughter to hold and she immediately started crinkling up the pages because she's an 8-month-old baby. And I was like, okay, this is your copy. And I signed it I put it on our shelf and I think I was like, this is your only copy. You messed it up. You will have to purchase another copy if you want one.
Oh man. Are you going to let her read it?
Yeah, I think when she's in, I mean, it's filthy. So I think when she's like in late high school, mm-hmm. she'll probably find a way to read it before then.
Sure. She'll find her crinkled copy.
I found a way to read. My parents had some dirty books in the house that they hid from me, and I found a way to find them and read them. So they're watching this. I actually never revealed that. So I found the stash, Mom and Dad. It was in your bedroom, in your dresser. I knew.
Oh, boy.
I would read them while you weren't home.
So you had the book deal. What did you have when you got the book deal? Did you have an idea of what you wanted to write about? Or did you, was that part of the deal? Or did you just kind of...
No, it wasn't. The core of what I knew I wanted to write about was basically the first story in the book, which is this seventh grade prank, because it's this kind of foundational story. You know, we all have like these stories we tell ourselves or these narratives that we repeat. And like that story about this, basically in seventh grade, the most popular kids paid the most popular guy in school to ask me out is this like school-wide prank. And it was foundational and it's a funny story and terrible. And I knew, okay. And I'd been telling it at storytelling shows. And part of my debate in writing the book was, well, what do I want to say in this book that I can't say in something else, in Crazy Ex-Girlfriend or any TV show I'm going to do in the future? What is specific to a book? And it started with very personal, specific stories from my own life that I could tell in a funny way. And then I just kind of extrapolated from there. So it kind of started with that core story. And then once I thought about the emotions of that story, it connected me to a piece after it about like how to get revenge on your middle school bullies. Cause I had actually wrote about that in my diary, but I wanted to do an update version of that. And then it also clued me into the way that I felt on my first TV writing staff when I was in my 20s, which was also a very emotionally impactful moment in my life. It felt like I was 13. So originally that first part of the book, took place when I was 13 and then when I was in my 20s. And then the book jumped around in time a lot more. And then my editor very wisely was like, it's a little disjointed. I think you need to make it more linear. But that was the start of it. And then originally I was going to call the book Dorkasaurus. And then I was like, I thought I'd made up that term. And then I looked it up. I'm like, oh no, there are t-shirts with this. And it just felt, oh, well, I don't want to like co-opt a phrase other people have used. And it also felt a little soft, especially when I thought of the new title. I was in the middle of writing the part about my fifth grade teacher, kind of at the height of my OCD anxiety, whatever you want to call it. When it happened when I was 9 and a half, 10 years old. My fifth grade teacher said, normal kids don't dress the way you do, which is another foundational experience of my life. It was probably the most horrible thing an adult ever said to me. I wanted to have a title that addressed that core gut feeling of like, I'm not normal. Mm-hmm. And at the same time I was like, well, I also want to like acknowledge the fan base and also acknowledge that this book is going to have a musical in it. And that's when I settled on, I want to be where the normal people are. And that just felt instantly right.
It was spot on. I love that it has an
author
and absolutely everything. And yeah, you were talking about, you know, dealing with the question of what is normal throughout the
book. Oh, sorry. My mom just wrote in, hi, Rachel, we're listening. I'm sorry. Great. That just popped up.
Do you think they ever read that section that you told them to explicitly like not read?
Oh yeah. I'm pretty sure I've talked to my parents. The only section they didn't read was Harry Potter. Cause they haven't read Harry Potter. No, I think they read the section.
You basically deal in the book a lot with what is it to be normal? What is normal? Who decides what is normal? And, And I felt like I really connected to that because I don't know to this day if it's something that everybody thinks or if everybody kind of, if it's just me and you or, you know, if sort of what is normal, am I normal? Is what I'm feeling normal? And sort of having spent some time dealing with this now, do you think you would go back and have a conversation with younger Rachel, which you do in the book, but I mean, specifically about that, would you sort of tell her how to be normal? Would you change her in that way? Or would you let her figure it out for herself and turn into you?
Oh, no, I'd probably let her figure out. I'm ultimately happy. So I would unfortunately let her go through. Otherwise, I mean, I just watched an episode of Lovecraft Country about time travel that was much more serious than what we're talking about and involving people letting terrible things happen so that their current lives can manifest. But anyway, no, I would allow it to happen to her. However, I think that a lot of me talking about this stuff now is my way of going back in time and talking to my younger self, because it's my way of talking to anyone who might be currently going through this. And in saying it aloud right now, I think that that probably is a motivation for a lot of artists. This idea of working through things from the past and hoping to, by like kind of affecting people's lives now who might be feeling things you felt in the past, it's healing for your past self.
Sure. I find myself having a lot of conversations with young me. And I don't know any more people. I mean, not that they've spoken to me about it. You know, I've never had conversations with anyone about it. So reading it in your book, I was like, this is exactly how my brain works. Sort of every new thing that happens, I'm like, would young Yale be proud? Would she be impressed? Would she be happy? Do you think young Rachel might be pissed that you shared pieces of her diary? Have you had a conversation with her about it?
God, I'm trying to actually really put myself.
Because she worked so hard to.
I'd be.
Of like erotic.
Mortified. I'd be mortified. But then I think if you were like, but it's okay because you're using it for a book and you're famous, I'd be like, oh, okay. You know, if I'm going to be honest, that's probably the way I would have. Now, all of the stuff I talk about with mental health, I don't know. Like, I don't know what I would have thought. My headspace was just so different back then.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's yeah.
The whole thing that you talk about OCD, I found it incredible. A, because I love that you specifically wrote that you like squeezed it out of your psychiatrist. Sort of.
Still very, very reluctant. I sent a book to him because I quote him on the back of my book. I saw that. So I was like, I sent him a book and I said, thanks for the advice. Love, patience, patient's privacy kept confidential.
I'm going to just read it. You wrote a legendary active imagination with a predisposition for anxiety. Sure, you can put this quote on the back of your book, I guess.
Which is exactly what happened. I was on the phone with him and he said that a legendarily active imagination with a predisposition for anxiety. And I went, hey, can that be a book quote? And he was like, sure.
No, I'm pretty sure nobody's ever done that before. I mean, I don't know, but I don't think so. I think
he was pretty tickled. He's been my dude for like 6 years now. Mm-hmm. We're really tight. I have his cell phone number.
Oh wow.
I'm really close with him. I mean, he trusts me to have his phone number. I mean, it's a testament to the second I found out Adam died, my songwriting partner, Adam Schlesinger, who passed away from COVID in March, to pivot to something incredibly sad. My daughter was a week old. I called him, my psychiatrist, like immediately. And I was like, I'm in crisis. What do I do? And I'd never called I'd had his cell phone number. I'd never like called it before like that or ever texted him. And like, I think because he was getting a call from me, was like, oh, this client never does this. This is probably a problem.
You're listening to comedian, actress, writer, singer, star of the television show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, Rachel Bloom, whose new book is I Want to Be Where the Normal People Are. She's joined in conversation by Yael Groklas on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Well, that sounds like the most horrible time imaginable.
Yeah. It was, but I really, having my psychiatrist in that moment was like really helpful. And it was interesting. The advice he gave me, I was like, what do I do? Cause my daughter was like on the bed with me. I was about to breastfeed. And you know, when they're newborns, they're just miserable to be there. They're not having a good time. They want to be back in the womb. And I'm like, what do I do? And the tip he gave me was, you know, while you're grieving, go to a space that is just your own, away from your daughter, where you can emote any way you want to.
Wow.
But find like a separation. And that was very, very, very helpful. And then of course, Gregor, my husband, like, you know, him being there was like, he took the baby while I could go cry.
Well, I guess you don't want those two to forever be, you know, entwined. So actually that's incredibly wise advice. You don't want to have the grief kind of take over you being a first time mom.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I think that also you want to, I think it's even a good like mental, because look, if I'd been like sobbing around her, I was still breastfeeding her and like crying a little bit. She definitely saw me cry, but I think it was more for me than her to like, the two can coexist. I can have a newborn in one room and feel grief in another, and it's okay. You know, life is these highs and these profound, intense highs and these profound intense lows. And it was just very like,
so this happened in the middle of you writing the book, all right?
Yeah, it was, I'd already turned in the first draft of the book, but it was right before I was about to make edits and changes, but there were parts of the book that were definitely like, it was semi-locked with some room for edits, hence like the afterword. And then I also added, I had Aline Brosh McKenna read the book, and she read it in one day because that's what she does. And she was like, I think you need some more stuff about Crazy Ex-Girlfriend in here.
Oh my God. I was just blown away by how you described, you know, the process of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, of everything that happened. It happened so fast. It's nothing like what people think, you know, people who aren't in show business, I think they have this idea of how these things happen. And, you know, from my experience, they never happen the way they're supposed to happen, but this is really extraordinary. You know, the ups and downs that you had with this process, with Crazy Ex, how it came to be.
As for anyone watching, I talk about it in the book, and I kind of go through the bullet points of like, here's how a normal TV show gets made. And then here's how mine got made. But Yael, did I meet you that first day at Upfronts? Is that when we first met?
The evening that we met. Yes, at Upfronts.
Yeah.
Did you not mention me? It was
clearly— I'm so sorry. I didn't mention you in the book. But I that's actually what blew me away about Upfronts, is everyone was so nice. And I was really honestly struck by how nice everyone from Jane the Virgin was.
Oh, thank you.
And yeah. I remember specifically, it was everyone, but like you and Jaime were like so warm and sweet at especially that Upfronts party, and just made me feel like mishpucha right away, and it was lovely.
I think it's the Israeli Mexican connection there about
the Israeli Mexican, yes.
Yeah. I remember that evening very well. It was, you were shining. I mean, you describe your stress over the dress and all those, you know, moments in the book. And to me, you just seemed the most confident, brilliant, sort of like, oh, I've got this. You know, I, of course, was dying inside and terrified, but you really seemed to have it all under control. So
I remember there was one guy who came, I won't name, but it was a guy who was on a superhero show. And he came up to me. He's like, your show looks good. And he walked away and everyone was like, he never talks to anyone. That was basically him giving you a huge hug. He's never been that warm. And he was like, good to see you.
Okay, later you have to tell me who that is because now I want to know who's in
there. Yeah, I'll tell you.
Because I'm like, who is this person?
I'll text you. It wasn't Grant Gustin.
Oh, no, Grant's the loveliest.
No. I think I said to Grant Gustin, though, what? I was so nervous that day of Upfronts and I was so punched drunk from lack of sleep. I said, like, he was like, hi, I'm Grant. I was like, you're so attractive and you're so nice. Wow, you're so nice for an attractive person. And he was like, yeah, cool. Okay.
You have a whole chapter named like Aline Hold My Underwear, right?
Yes, I do.
That whole day when you have to take my underwear.
Yeah. A lot of people, Aline has definitely held my underwear like numerous times.
Oh.
For one reason or another.
That's your next book. It's just called Aline Holds My Underwear.
Aline Hold My Underwear, yeah. And there is an extra book in just talking about Crazy Ex-Girlfriend and how it got made. But I want to give it some perspective, you know? I'd like to look back on it because I'm still kind of processing it in a way. It was such a whirlwind, as Rebecca Bunch would say.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, actually, you know, when I'm reading this, I'm thinking, oh, yeah, you made me remember so many things about all kinds of things that happened to me in life, you know, from being weird and feeling abnormal and all kinds of little details. But how on earth do you remember all of this? I feel like everything before age 17 or something is like a blur. And you seem to have, is it because you kept diaries? Is it because did you just go back and have to like talk to your parents a bunch or talk to friends from then? Or I know you had a conversation with one of your bullies.
I did. Yeah. I have my diaries. About 10 years ago, my mom was like, take your childhood. It's taking up room. We want to just get it. And it was a blessing because I now have this box full of all of my memorabilia. I mean, I have my yearbooks, but I have like essays, and then I have all my diaries and my creative writing notebooks. And so I have all of these like primary sources of my life at that time. And then plus I remember a lot of things very well because trauma or you know, adrenaline, good and bad, it makes memories stick in your mind. And so I really, really remember, especially at like events from like 9 to 12, when I started looking at notebooks, there's a poem in there that I wrote when I was 14 called Infatuated Like a Princess, which is actually, I think, the most mortifying part of the book. It's like a romantic poem I wrote when I was 14. I don't remember 14 and 15 as well, which I was, I think, just as awkward in some ways, but not as traumatized.
It's so funny because I, you know, looking at you and knowing you, you just, you don't come off as awkward. And I guess it's something that is so personal, you know, everybody's experience is so. And I also love how in the beginning of the book, you kind of have this part of when you're like, well, my bullies were worse than your bullies kind of thing, right?
You feel competitive with people. I think because also all of the stuff about high school and middle school, even when someone is bullied, tends to be like very soft. It doesn't really like convey the true misery of when you are picked on and what that feels like, which is why I really connected with the movie Welcome to the Dollhouse when I was 13, because it was one of the first and only things, especially at that time, that was like, yes, it is dark to be this age. And finally someone is showing that.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, a really great thing that I found that I loved in your book was that, you talk about this experience you had in a writer's room as an adult, as you were 23, I think, your first writer's room experience. And you talk about your conversation with the younger self, realizing that you're actually being bullied. And I thought that was absolutely brilliant because to me, I was like, oh my God, I felt like I've had so many moments like that. And I wouldn't think of them as bullying, because you think of bullying as something like your earlier experience of, you know, the hot guy being paid to fake ask you out or something terrible like that. When you're younger, you don't think about yourself as an adult being bullied. And suddenly I started thinking at all these moments in my life. I'm like, was I actually just bullied?
Yeah.
bullied. Like, it's such a brilliant way to think about it. Why is it any different? Bullies still exist when they're adults.
And it's that gray area of like, it wasn't like I was being like shoved into lockers, and it wasn't even like someone was like, "You're not funny. Shut the f- up." It's like more of a vibe, and I could point to like specific things that were said, but they're all like in context, and it just feels like you're going crazy. And in fact, something that was very validating is one of the bosses, the bosses themselves were very nice. One of the bosses took me aside and was like, "Some of the people in this room are mean. And one of them is a bully." And so that was nice to have like the validation of the boss saying that and acknowledging that, because I didn't know if I was going crazy or not. Now, to hear that acknowledged, it didn't help me. I literally felt my writing get, it was weird. I felt my writing in the room get worse and worse and worse, because I got more in this. I was already insecure coming into this room because I was 23 years old. I got the job based off of a spec script I wrote of 30 Rock. So I didn't even have an original pilot. I was incredibly green. And I remember actually at the time even asking my lawyer, like, what happens if I fail at this job? Like, I went in with a narrative of like, I'm scared. But I remember I had a really good first week. I actually had a really good confident first week. And that's when they started to take me down. It was only after I started to do well. And talking it out right now, actually, I'm like going through it in my head. And it was weird because they like saw themselves as like kind of mentors to me. They came to this one woman show that I did at UCB. And I sent one of the guys some early music videos that I did, and he like gave me notes. So there were all these weird gray areas to that bullying, to where maybe I thought I was like, I thought I was like imagining, well, maybe it's on me that I feel every day and that I feel less funny. Mm-hmm. But it's funny, I would get home and I would do some of my own writing, and it suddenly felt like I was back in the present. It felt like every day I stepped into the room, I was back to being 13, and that I would enter the present and my writing was better because I was in a writer's room with very funny people. It did make me better as a writer when I wasn't in that room. So I'm hoping, you know, we're talking about like all of these, like, I mean, Me Too has now become a kind of broad way to talk about hostility in the workplace, right? And there are many, many, many levels and grades of like what hostility in the workplace means. And I'm hoping that what it's getting us to is just a more empathetic state where if you are someone who lives in that space of like, well, I'm not technically bullying anyone, but you can tell you're making someone upset, that you can check yourself a little more. Because in 2010, 2011, that wasn't a thing.
I also love that you don't name them by name and that you kind of give them an opportunity to correct themselves, like you said.
I don't want to get anyone targeted or canceled from this. It's just not the point. And, they know how I feel. The right people know how I feel about it. And it's also why I make an emphasis to say, like, not everyone at that job was me. Because it's true. I am friends with some people who worked at that job. That is something that I, like, was very specific about in the book. And also when talking about ex-boyfriends, like, knowing that I'd be doing events like this, knowing that these words were going to be forever, I wanted to make sure that I could stand behind every word that I wrote so that in talking to you or in talking to a journalist or whatever, I could be like, yes, I did write that. And if someone were to email me and be like, you said this, that I could say like, yeah, I did, because it's my story to tell, you know, and that I wouldn't be like, I shouldn't have said that. That was just me being petty in the moment.
I completely agree with you. I think it's handled beautifully. I think it really gives people an opportunity to be like, oh, you know, because some people I think are, first of all, there's this lie that we're told all the time when we're young, like, oh, they're bullying you because they're jealous.
Yeah.
All that. And you're like, no, sometimes maybe, but no, they're not jealous. Sometimes they're just dicks, you know, and sometimes maybe somebody has their own insecurities and maybe they don't notice. And so this is such a brilliant way to be like, you know what, this is how I felt. So, you know, you made me feel this way. Don't make people feel like this in the future.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I said to, I call him Matthew. When I talked to him years later, I was like, look out for the underdog.
Yes.
Just like, look out for the little guy. Because they don't see it that way. They don't see themselves as the underdog.
And that's such a great,
or they don't see the underdog as the underdog. They see themselves as the underdog.
Right. Probably everybody does. Yeah. When I did a guest role on Crazy Ex, and I felt like you really took that with you, you know, there, because it felt like even just being there for a day or two, it felt like, you know, you really went, once you became the boss, you created such a warm, kind environment where everybody was treated really nicely. That was my experience anyway, you know.
Thank you.
Nobody was being bullied, and you sort of really had a handle on that. So it's you clearly like learned something from, you know, all your past experiences and took it on to make such a pleasant environment for other people, which is
thank you. Great. I actually almost had to learn the opposite lesson, which is I was like, I'm going to be friendly to everyone, and forgetting that, no, I'm the boss and there's a power in that. And so, you know, occasionally people would be afraid to tell me things. I'd be like, why are you afraid of me? And someone, Aline or someone, would have to be like, cause you're their boss. And it just reminded me, oh, right. There's always a different power dynamic. Even if you're like, hey, my buddy, that doesn't change the ultimate dynamic. And so a lot of me learning to be a boss was managing and balancing wanting to be palsy-wowsy with everyone, which I still do, and acknowledging that, like, other people may not feel as much that way just because they're like, but that's my boss, you know?
I guess when you have the power to get somebody fired, like, they don't, you know, it's just a different dynamic.
Yeah, it is. And I was so young, too, and so I was, Crazy Ex, I was 28, 29, and so to be the boss, some of the people I was a boss over in their 50s, 60s, it's very, very weird.
I didn't think about it. You came off as so confident and you know, and on top of things. Although you did a lot of your writing on the toilet in your trailer. And I do think I've texted with you when you were on the toilet in your trailer.
You probably have. That is, well, that's the only time that I could just be alone.
Yeah.
The only kind of incontrovertible time that I could say, this is my alone space. And so it was a lot of, yeah, I texted with most people on the toilet.
But I think, you know, you describe your schedule there and it sounds unreal. Like, I don't know how you're alive and still wrote a book, how you have energy to do anything, but you're clearly, you have, you know, you're amazing and a genius.
Thank you. But, you know, it's also necessity. Like, I did that job because I had to. There was no, I mean, you get it. Like, when you're on set and you're tired, you can't just be, I mean, I've heard of TV shows where some actors go like, I'm tired, I'm going home. You can't do that on the CW. You don't have the money to do that on the CW. Maybe you could do that on an HBO show or something, but you have to do what you have to do. You either do the job or it's going to be a real problem.
Well, yes. You know? So, like, kind of a million people depend on, I mean, not a million, but thousands of people depend on you showing up and doing your job. So,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But one of the things I was thinking about you being bullied, you mentioned that you are so terrible at coming up with like a good comeback in the moment in the book, which I love because I feel like so just learn how to curse in a different language. You don't have to. So if someone ever comes at you, and you can't think of a good answer, if you just sort of cuss them out in Hebrew or something.
Yeah. I like that because what it does is it makes you high status because they can't understand what you're saying. So it automatically makes you come from, how do you say like in Hebrew?
The point is, look, if they don't speak Hebrew, they don't know what you're saying. So say anything. You could say like table and just look like you're cursing. It'll work.
Bet shimush.
Yeah, bet shimush. And they're like...
She's so cool.
She just said toilet. Like a fancy word for toilet. When you says betchimush, it's like saying like, what's a fancy word for
like powder room.
There are quite a few Hebrew names that you don't want to have in the States.
Like Nimrod.
Nimrod, Moran.
Moran's a Hebrew name?
I mean, it's Moran, but yeah.
Oh, that's sad.
I mean, it's a beautiful name. It's just, you know, sometimes, yeah, it's not, you know, doesn't translate well. I'm sure there are English names that sound terrible in Hebrew as well, but I'll think of them.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is comedian, actress, writer, singer, and star of the television show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, Rachel Bloom, whose new book is I Want to Be Where the Normal People Are. She's joined in conversation by Yael Groquas. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
When I was a kid, and my mom's on here, maybe she remembers, she told me to tell people that they had a charisma bypass, which looking back on it, I don't know if that makes sense, but I definitely used that line once or twice.
Rachel, I have to ask you about Disneyland. What's up with Disneyland?
What's up? My parents and I I grew up 45 minutes away from Disneyland, and so my parents got us year-long passes when I was, starting in second grade into maybe fifth or, no, it was like maybe we stopped in fifth grade and then we kept up again in like seventh through 12th grade. But in like second grade, sometime, occasionally on a school night, we would go to Disneyland for a couple hours. It was really sick.
And how often do you go now?
Well, now I don't go because it's not open. Well, no, because it's not open. It's because of COVID. I have once a week, I have recurring dreams that I'm at Disneyland. In non-COVID times, I go three times a year.
Three times a year?
Yeah.
And it doesn't get boring?
No.
That's amazing.
No.
Disneyland. I need to see it through your eyes.
Have you not been?
I've been twice.
Okay.
But I have to go back now. Not now.
It's the rides there. Cause also they're really upping their game on the rides. So like there are all these new rides. Like there's, you know, Star Wars Rise of the Resistance, which I still haven't been on. But then when I go on the rides, it's like watching your favorite childhood movie, but you're in it. So the Indiana Jones ride, I know every dip, contour, moment of that ride. I could do it in my, I could, if there were a way for me to like draw a ride or animate it with my brain, I could do that entire ride by memory. And I love it. I love being on it. And growing up in Southern California, this is very common, to the point a friend of mine in high school was so obsessed with Disney, and he actually now continues to work at Disneyland. He had a Jeep, a friend, he had like his parents' Jeep for the summer. Mm-hmm. And in his high school parking lot, it was like he went to a neighboring high school. He managed in his Jeep, while playing the song played on the Indiana Jones ride, to recreate every turn and dip on the Indiana Jones ride in the parking lot of, if anyone knows, Palos Verdes Peninsula High School. And we were in this Jeep and we were careening around going down to, it was so dangerous. It was so dangerous. And it was one of the most fun moments of my life. We were wearing seatbelts. And I say it was so dangerous, meaning like, had anyone been in that parking lot? But like, he managed to recreate that entire ride in this parking lot. It was so cool.
What would you do if your daughter doesn't like Disneyland? Is that even a possibility?
I don't know. You've stumped me.
Sorry, I hadn't planned this question. This is just, this came up.
I mean, I'd still love her.
You sure?
I think then it would just be my thing. You know what? Here's the upside. If my daughter doesn't like Disney or Disneyland or amusement parks, the upside of that, or the thing that I can take from that, is it'll just be then for me. And it'll just be my special thing. And that's okay.
to explain like I need a child with me so mommy doesn't look weird, or
I've never needed that before to go to Disneyland.
That's true.
Yeah. Someone said you'll save money. That's funny. But yeah, I think that that's the way. I don't want to impress upon her that she has to like the things I like because they're my things, and that's okay. She's going to have her things. I'm excited if she's very strong. She's like a very strong baby, and she might be good at sports. I actually think that would be really cool to have a kid who's good at sports. I would learn so much about sports, and I would love to learn about if she was like a swimmer to go to like swim meets. What a whole new thing for me to learn about. I'm excited for her to be different, but also it's funny. CBS This Morning did a profile on me, and they came to the house. They did like a distance shoot. And they were like, could we tape you with your playing with your daughter? And the way I've been about her is just for now, I haven't shared her name really publicly because it's really more like I want her to have the benefit of not being able to be Googled for as long as possible, almost for like her own benefit. And then I don't really show her face. It's the my friend David Hull, White Josh on Crazy X, says it's the Wilson from Home Improvement rule. We basically only want to show like this or like side, you know. But it was funny because I was like, yes, you can show me playing with my daughter. So I put her in this like little play bouncer thing that stands her up away from the camera. So she's turned away from the camera and we're playing. And then she unfailingly goes like this at lens. So your lens, she's playing and she's just like, so I mean, look, the odds are in our favor, she will be a showman, but I will not put that on her.
I'm being told that now is time to take some audience questions.
Well, there are so many, I see.
Okay, Alexis is asking, what advice do you have for staying creative during COVID while we can't perform live?
Well, I think things like this, I think if you do any performing, a lot of people are having virtual shows. I haven't really done virtual stand-up, but my friend Danny's been doing some virtual stand-up shows. There are ways to connect with people. And then also I think for better and for worse, COVID times, it's opening up, I think, a part of our consciousness and the world's consciousness that I know that I have thought more about grief and loss and the tenuousness of like existence more than I ever have before. So I think let this moment, knowing that you're living through this extremely, like, this is history. We're living in history right now. This is going to be studied. It's going to be like when you meet someone who lived through the Great Depression or someone who like fought in World War II. It's that. So I think, I don't know, using that and saying like, okay, I'm actually like learning a lot about myself and learning a lot about the world. And I think about what we're going through and especially the idea of a disease wiping out people we love and making everybody sick. This is most of human existence. Most of human existence is a recurring illness that takes people out. You think about smallpox, bubonic plague, Ebola, and then, of course, 100 years ago, the Spanish flu, which killed, I want to say, 50 million people. This is, I think, we have the kind of charmed existence a lot of us have had without a pandemic in our lives is more of an outlier if you look at history.
Samantha asks, I'm in school right now to become a therapist. Your favorite people. I would love to know what was it about your favorite therapists or mental health professionals that made them your favorite?
Well, I mean, my psychiatrist had said to me that he is like, everyone should be with someone that they feel is as smart or smarter than they are. And I really feel like and also because I'm with the psychiatrist, I can ask him all of my fun medical questions. I'm always learning stuff from him. So look, personally for me, I like a psychiatrist or a therapist being there as like a teacher to really guide me. I like them being an active participant in my life. And I like the advicey route. I like a more active therapist, but that might be very personal to me.
I agree with you. I don't want someone to just listen. You know, I like someone who's actually sort of part of the conversation.
Yeah, I like getting that advice.
Thank you. There's a question actually for both of us. If you could be in one another's shows, JTV and Crazy Ex-Girlfriends, which character would you want to play?
Well, I mean, Yael was already on Crazy Ex-Girlfriends, so.
And Katrina.
is there any other character you'd want to play?
I'd want to play your character, but I'd be a terrified with the singing.
It's okay. We dub you.
Great. If I can be dubbed, great. Then.
If I were on your show, I'd want to play Jaime's part.
That's what I always say. If they ask me what other character, I'm like, Rogelio.
Rogelio's like the, I mean, what a, that would just be so fun.
You'd kill it as a Nishka though, too.
Thank you.
And as Petra, of course, but you know, Aneshka would be hilarious. If Aneshka could sing, that's a whole. Okay. Rachel is asking, were there parts of the book that you had planned out before you even knew you would be able to write one?
Yeah, there were some certain stories that I knew, like the story about being pranked, the story about my elementary school crush, who would like insult me at every turn. The last story in the book of called The Quest to Make Everyone Like Me, I had been outlining that and planning them out for quite some time.
That one's fantastic. That it really threw me, by the way. I thought that you were just telling a real story. And I was like,
oh. I know it was, it's unique in that it is the hybrid of everything in the book where it's framed like a personal essay. But it is complete fiction.
Thankfully. Cause it yes. got, I was like, Rachel, are you okay? So Amy's asking, do you have any advice for a graduating college student on getting into film, TV, and writing if I'm coming from an aerospace engineering background?
Wait, graduating college student coming from an aerospace engineering background who wants to get into film, TV, and writing? Well, the great thing is you're bringing something to the table a lot of us aren't, myself included, which is you come from aerospace engineering. Bring that. What a fascinating, if I were interviewing for a writer's room and someone was like, I have an aerospace engineering background. Oh my God, you've been doing something other than just comedy. There's actually a lot you can bring to the table. So I would lean into write a pilot, write something inspired by that. Like, don't shy away from who you are. Don't shy away from all of your skills. Like, you can bring such a unique perspective to the table. Even if you want to write like a comedy about, you know, three gals living together in the city, you can still make one of them an engineer because that's way more specific than like someone being vaguely working in PR, which is, you know, the job of most people on television shows.
Yeah, I was just about to say, I'd read that pilot. Like that sounds brilliant. I want to read a pilot about that. Someone's asking if someone were to perform the character of Rachel Bloom in the movie of your life, who would you like to perform it? Now, remember, this happened for Dr. Fauci.
Oh, yeah. Wait, so it's a movie of my life and I have to choose an actor?
Did you see that thing that Dr. Fauci, like...
Oh, yeah. It was Brad Pitt. It's great.
And then he did it. So just, you know, give it some thought because it might happen.
I kind of think a drag queen is the only actual real option. I think it would be a dual role. Played by Ms. Cracker and Bob the Drag Queen. And they would be like double cast somehow.
Maybe one like now, one your future self?
Yeah, or they'd trade off scenes. It would be kind of a smash. If anyone watched Smash, you know, the Ivy Lynn and Karen, right? It's Ivy and Karen. It would be kind of an Ivy Karen thing. They'd like trade off roles.
Amazing. And
Karen Cartwright, thank you, Karen Cartwright.
I have my question which is my final question for you. Have you left out some good juicy stuff for us for book number two?
Good juicy stuff. Yeah.
Okay. So I have a small request. Yeah. Could you entire thing from the perspective of your dog?
Oh, yes. Yes. That's a great idea. I could definitely write a book about my life only from Wiley's perspective.
Genius.
That's actually a great idea. Maybe I'll just do that because that was my favorite chapter to write.
It was so great. I don't remember if we talked about it already, but it's she describes the golden winning the Golden Globes, bringing home the Golden Globe, and just her dog not giving.
And she thinks the Golden Globe is trash because you can't play with it. Yeah, she couldn't care less.
You have a voice for your dog, do you do?
Yeah, and I do it on the audiobook, but here, I'll read a little bit of like, I need to read a little bit to get into like, let's find the, oh yeah, the Wiley chapter.
I was trying to imagine the voice.
Yeah.
No, I see.
Okay, this is when she goes into the, okay. That night, Mommy Man and Stepdad Lady had been away for a long time. I know this because their scent disappeared in the house in the way that it only does when they gone for hours. So then they come to house smelling of excitement and champagne, and Stepdad Lady is holding some sort of hard golden toy in her hand. She kneels down and says, Mommy just won a Golden Globe, Wiley. I don't know what that is. 2, you're not Mommy. 3, gold toy too hard for Wiley to chew and destroy. 4, gold toy is trash. That's my Wiley voice.
I don't have an accent. That's brilliant.
Thank you so much.
Anyway, that's all the questions I have for you.
I know that there are so many other more questions. And we are, there's one dismissed question on this Q&A. Oh God, I just want to look at what that one is. Oh, it was just someone had a typo. That's it. Oh, I thought it was going to be something really mean.
I was curious. Like, what are they just saying? Are they just cursing for an entire sentence?
Because I can see the whole Q&A and questions. But anyway, I think we probably have to wrap up, right?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, guys, can you come back tomorrow? I wouldn't. Just thank you so, so much. Thank you to Rachel. Thank you, Yael. And then come back and see us for more virtual events. And until then, take care and good night. So much love to you guys.
Good night. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
I'll text you, Yael.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was comedian, actress, writer, singer, and star of the television show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, Rachel Bloom, whose new book is I Want to Be Where the Normal People Are. She was joined in conversation by actress Yael Groplas. I'm David Kwan, editor and producer of the program, and Tina Pamintuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Roshanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.